Team MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist. Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. When it comes to making an occasion special, we often open a bottle of wine and raise our glasses in a toast. But what wine to choose? Today we're going to talk about wine. Our guest is Brad Beam. He's here at the University of Illinois. We're going to talk with him about learning to appreciate the sensory delights of wine, pairing wines with food, and I think we'll also try and talk with him a bit about wineries here in Illinois. Listeners, what questions do you have about wine? Do you have a tip to share, a story to share? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Brad Beam, joined the University of Illinois in the fall of 2006. He provides extension support for commercial wineries in Illinois. He also teaches an introductory course on wine production and sensory analysis at the U of I. Questions about wine? Give us a call. Talk to Brad. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Good to see you.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great.
Well, what led you to this field?
I had kind of an interesting path. I'm actually a horticulturist.
Okay.
Okay, and I actually started my career here at the University of Illinois in horticulture. After finishing up my undergrad program here at U of I, I ended up kind of doing some undergrad internship work on the West Coast in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. And out there, just turning 21, just being, you know, the ripe age for tasting wine and getting into some wine exploration, really got bit by the bug while I was out west.
Yeah.
While I was out there, you know, it became clear to me that there was a little industry developing in Illinois and developing pretty rapidly. So I ended up coming back to attend graduate school down at Southern Illinois University, again for horticulture and grape production. After getting that degree taken care of, I ended up taking a position up at the University of Minnesota as their research winemaker. They actually have a breeding program up in Minnesota where they breed extreme cold hardy grape varieties. And my job, which everyone tells me is a great job, and I thought it was certainly a fun time, was to get to make all the wines. So they would do a single cross, you know, hand pollinate flowers from one grape to another, collect the seeds, plant the seeds after 3 or 4 years, start to get a little bit of fruit. And so it was my job to make whatever wine I could out of whatever fruit they had, which was kind of challenging. We would make anything from 5 gallons to 250 milliliters, and that would be one single wine. So kind of amateur winemaking on a just insane scale, really. We would make, you know, 100, 250 wines a year.
Yeah. This industry seems to just be booming in the Middle West.
It really is, all over, but in Illinois especially. Part of that boom is really related to the new grape varieties that have come out of the University of Minnesota breeding program, and also Cornell breeding program. They've been releasing new varieties that are really well adapted to our climate and are of superior wine quality as opposed to, or as compared to the wines that we had even 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Brad Beam. He's with the University of Illinois, and we're talking about wine. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Watseka on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Brad, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm located about 50 miles north of Champaign-Urbana in Watseka, so you know where I'm at.
Yes.
And I have some, prime farm property where I grow corn and soy and wheat. I rotate them. But I'd like to put in one long line of grapes.
Mm-hmm.
So my basic question is, what kind of grapes should I plant, and how do I go about that?
Okay. Well, the first question I have for you is, what do you want to do with them? There are hundreds of grape varieties out there.
Right. I would like to be able to make my own wine eventually, but I would settle for just some good eating grapes if I couldn't grow a grape that I could produce wine with.
Okay. Well, first of all, the thing you should know is that all the traditional grape varieties that you've probably heard of, things like Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon, are out of the picture.
Right.
What I would look to, probably for the backyard in the northern half of Illinois, would be grape varieties that have come out of that University of Minnesota program. I'm a little biased, but I think they are, of pretty high wine quality, and I know they're definitely cold hardy enough to handle your winter conditions. There are probably four that are worth looking at. Frontenac is the one that is probably most available, and it's a red grape variety. There is a sport or a mutation of it, just like Pinot Gris is a mutation of Pinot Noir, called Frontenac Gris, which makes a very tropical, fruity, white table wine, more dessert style than dry Chardonnay style. But those are probably two grapes that you have that you can find that are available to you. Now, you'd have to look for specialty nurseries, probably in Iowa or Minnesota, to try to find these grape varieties.
But and if I went to a website to get the correct spelling of Frontenac, mm-hmm. Frontenac Green, what would that website be?
I'd probably go to, hate to promote Minnesota, but grapes.umn.edu. They have a list of the grape varieties that they've released, and they also have a complete list of nurseries that you can contact.
That'd be great. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Other calls are invited about wine, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's take a real practical kind of situation and talk about it here this afternoon. I'm going to get together with some friends on kind of a spur of the moment kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And my host asks me to bring a bottle of wine. So there I am, going to make this impromptu dash to the supermarket and then to meet with my friends. If you were there to guide me, what would you suggest?
That's a question I get a lot.
Yeah.
People want to know, what should I bring to a party? And the answer is, there are a couple answers. But one is to bring something that you like unapologetically, no matter what it is. If you only like white Zinfandel, only bring white Zinfandel, to the party. When you're hosting something, which is a different set of directions or instructions, it's always important to make sure that you have wine that is somewhat unintimidating. You don't want to take it real highbrow unless that happens to be the crowd that you hang out with. It's always good to have something that people recognize and don't get too intimidated by. It's real easy in the wine world, and we're full of snobs anyway. But it's very fun. It's very easy to force intimidation on people and make people uncomfortable by your wine selection. So
yeah.
I would never aim for anything.
That's not the crowd I'm looking for.
Something fun?
Come on. This should be...
Okay. Well, something simple, fun, fruity. Whites are usually more of a crowd pleaser, at least in the past. Reds are starting to come on strong. So something like a nice light Sauvignon Blanc, or you know, I guess the other question is it with dinner? Is it supposed to be a food wine? Then something like Chardonnay or Chablis from Burgundy would be great. Just very simple, very clean, you know, somewhat fruity whites are probably a good safe selection.
Yeah, and if it's something that you know and you like, you can say something about it. And the other thing, I suppose, with a party setting like that is every, you know, there's something for, there should be something for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
With
yeah.
somebody, if you're bringing wine.
And I think everybody should, you know, it doesn't matter what wine you bring as long as you know how to present it. You know, if you bring one of those $75 Napa Cabernet Sauvignons or something and everyone feels like they have to know something in order to be worthy of tasting it with you, that's usually a sets up the mood to be negative, you know. So bringing something that's accessible is usually a safe bet, something fun.
Yeah. Now, what if you want to get together with some folks and you want to just do kind of a wine in small bites kind mm-hmm. of a thing? And the idea is to have the wine as the star of the party, you know, kind of a little bit of fun, some education along the way. Any ideas there?
Well, there are two main ways to do this, and you just said the wine's the star of the party, so then you would want to go for something a little more upscale, mm-hmm. something a little more interesting that you might be specifically into. You know, for example, you know, I happen to really like tannic red wines, and usually the more painful the better, you know, and there are a lot of wine people out there that feel the same way. That's the kind of wine I wouldn't necessarily bring to a light party that, you know, I know people aren't really into wine nearly as much as I am. But I would to other wine people, other wine friends, something like Amarone, which is extremely tannic and really dark and fruity. The other way to look at one of those is when the food is really the star. It's always important not to bring wine that's going to overpower the food. You know, if you want the food to really be the star, go for something light and simple. If you want the wine to be the star, go ahead and go for something a little more robust with a little more stronger flavor and tannin and complexity.
Yeah. Maybe you'd give us a couple of examples. Let's say we're going to have pork rib roast.
Mm-hmm.
What might we want to serve with that? And I'll give you a couple other foods.
Okay. I teach this in my wine appreciation class at U of I. We do one little lesson on wine and food pairing. And, you know, I tell them in class that there are books out there, and you have one in the studio here, I see, but that have pages and pages and pages of specific matchings. What I try to get them to do is think about structural components of each.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about pork roast, something like that, I think of something with some strong smoky flavor, probably, if it's been roasted, something real salty. Generally, pork usually is pretty salty, all the pork dishes. So it's important to have something that will complement that fairly well. Now, salt actually will enhance the perception of astringency and acidity in wines. So with a pork dish, it's not a bad idea to go with either a low tannin red or even a white with a little hint of residual sugar. Something that's a little off dry, because it'll actually the salt content makes it seem less sweet, so it actually brings the wine into balance that way.
Okay, how about beef?
Something beef has a lot of fat. Okay, mm-hmm. generally, unless it's something real lean like veal.
Mm-hmm.
So the fat actually and the protein will bind with tannin in red wines. The flavor is usually too strong in beef to really work well with a lot of whites. So that's why they usually say red meat, red wine.
Mm-hmm.
That usually holds up pretty well because of the flavor issues. Something I tell my students to do is think about what you would season the food with or what kind of sauce you might put on it. And you know, if it's like a fruit sauce or something like that for reds, you wouldn't choose probably lemon. You probably wouldn't choose pineapple, you know, with beef, which are two aromatic and flavor components common in white wines. You might choose something like cherry or a blackberry or some kind of red fruit to go with it. And so those are flavor components that usually show up in red wines. So that would probably be a better match. Now, if the beef's real fatty, probably something like a Cabernet Sauvignon from the Napa Valley would be just fine. Bordeaux from France. Syrah, Grenache, those wines, red Rhones from France, would all work really, really well.
Okay. What about a vegetarian risotto dish?
Ooh. It all depends on the seasoning in that case.
Yeah.
If it's a red sauce or something a little tomato-based, you'd probably want to shy toward red. If it's something herby, you know, something that has some herbs in it, it would probably be a toss-up. You know, if it's something that has some vegetative character, you might try a Sauvignon Blanc. You know, something like an oak-aged Sauvignon Blanc from California might work really well. It's highly acidic, but it also has a grassy element to it. And can be really, really nice to pair with foods.
Yeah. And here now, next, I'm going to suggest something like a big pasta dish, like a bolognese sauce or lasagna or spaghetti and meatballs or pizza. Would I be wise to go, because that comes from a certain region of the world, to go for an Italian?
Not a bad way to look at it. Yeah. If you're really up in arms about it and you're not really sure, it's not a bad idea to just go regionally and pick foods. Now, tomatoes, you know, are a New World crop, not an Italian crop by nature within their history. But probably going with a Chianti or something like that would be fine. I would tend to, if I have pizza or something that has a lot of salt and a lot of fat or salty cheese like Parmesan, I tend to go with low tannin reds, something that's not quite as astringent because it's a little softer. The flavors are still there. Actually, probably the best wine pairing I can think of with a lasagna or a pizza would be Chambersin, which is a grape variety that's grown in southern Illinois.
Really?
It's a real low tannin red. Has some cherry components. Can be real complex. It can get some tobacco-like character in it too. Some both cigarette and cigar tobacco, and it's real light in tannin, so it doesn't really. The salt content of those cheeses don't really interfere with the wine at all.
Very good. And I'm wondering, too, if there might be an occasion where you might want to do something opposite what you've got. Let's say you've got something that's a tad sweet. Mm-hmm. Would you want to pair it with something that's got some pepper, some punch?
Oh, from a flavor perspective?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, there are two real concepts behind food matching, and one is to complement the flavors and the other is to contrast the flavors. Now, most of us out there aren't necessarily world-class wine evaluators, so I tend to shy away from getting into flavor matching too much for the novice, because, you know, the whole spectrum of flavor in food and wine is so vast that it would be easy to mess it up. So I usually tell them to focus on the structural components, the acidity, astringency in red wines, and overall flavor intensity. You know, is the wine really strongly flavored? Is it real light? Is it an example of a really lightly aromatic wine? It'd be something like Grave, which is a white Bordeaux, which is just a real lean, real light, can have some honey-like character, can have some light fruit, but nothing too intense. Something that would go well with, you know, a lot of dishes. Wouldn't necessarily be the star of the show, but might complement a lot of foods.
Yeah. You know, it's so easy to be overwhelmed. And I think it's important to just kind of relax and have a nice time. But
yeah.
You mentioned the book that I have here in the studio with us this afternoon, What to Drink with What You Eat. It's a really nice basic kind of beginner's look at how to pair food and wine. And most of the book is spent going through all kinds of dishes and ingredients and suggestions. But the front part of the book, they actually have people who know something about wine talking about it. And one of the folks who they quote in the early going in the book is a fellow by the name of Patrick O'Connell, who's at the inn at Little Washington in Virginia. And he's noted that for his staff, some of whom have quite a bit of experience, you know, they too feel a little intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that can happen to anyone.
Oh, absolutely. And that's kind of why I you know, if you do have, or one of those people that does have dinner parties, is a very has a lot of anxiety about food and wine pairing, a book like that's a really good idea, because it'll give you kind of a short list of wines that will pair well with different types of foods. And if that's what you're looking for, that's great. I try to get my students to be able to improvise a little bit more, because, you know, that's the point of the class, is to teach them a little bit about food and wine pairing from a structural perspective. And so that's kind of why I work with things like acidity, astringency, flavor intensities, those kinds of things. By the end of the semester, which is this week, they are pretty good now at picking out a lot of the major aromatic components of red, white wines, dessert wines, sparkling wines, etc. So I'm feeling confident in that they're going to start experimenting more and more with flavor, contrast, and comparing.
Yeah. What motivates these students to sign up for your class? a range of motives out here.
I think the number one is probably wine. The fact that they get to taste wine in class, sight unseen, that's probably enough of a motivation for most seniors in college, you know. But that's usually why they sign up. And then about 3 weeks in, they realize that it's not quite the party that they had hoped for. And we actually
some work to do.
Yeah, we actually do a lot of work and actually really take a serious look at these wines and really try to teach them to pick them apart from a sensory perspective.
Yeah, let's take another call. A listener now joining us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes, I was wondering, when you're talking about breeds of that you could grow, what's the genetic potential of our native grapes? Do they have some resistance properties, like phylloxera resistance or something like that, or do they have certain qualities of harvest? They're very small grape, like about a quarter inch across, but I imagine there's a bunch of subgroups where there could be something that we're going to get bred, and if someone in Illinois is wanting to grow grapes, it might be interesting for them to try using their own grapes.
Using their truly native species. He's talking about Vitis riparia, which is the riverbank grape, and it's
right. So along the railroad bed, where there's any prairie left,
mm-hmm.
You stumble over it because you stumble over the vines.
Right.
It's very easy to cuss it out sometimes.
Yeah, they are definitely survivors and do really well in our climate and soils. They aren't great for wine production. They tend to make very, very dark red, high acid wine, low tannin, don't really work too well. I've actually made wines from this grape before. It's one of the principal breeding lines that they use up at the University of Minnesota because it's very cold hardy up there and is also very disease resistant. Its negatives are that it has really tiny fruit, like you were saying, and it's really hard to get juice out of it. You have to crush it and add pectic enzyme to it, try to break it down, and then you find out that the sugar content is about 25, and the acid content's about 25 grams per liter.
Some of that could be changed with breeding.
Yeah, and they are. That's exactly what the University of Minnesota is doing. Frontenac, that grape I mentioned earlier, is actually half wild riparia. One of its parents is uh-huh. pure wild grape.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your comment there.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about wine this afternoon. Our guest is Brad Beam. He's here at the University of Illinois. He provides extension support for commercial wineries in Illinois. He also teaches an introductory course on wine production and sensory analysis here at the U of I. And we're talking with him this afternoon about wine, learning to appreciate the sensory delights of wine, pairing wines with food, and wineries in Illinois, the grapes that we can grow here in the Midwest. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next we go to a listener in Marshall on line four. Hi.
Hello.
Hey there.
Hi. I'm very timely on your program today. I'm in process of transferring from primary to secondary on a batch of wine here, and I'm interested from the standpoint I've been a hobbyist for probably 10 years, kind of hit and miss to begin with, but at least now most of my fans are asking for more and more bottles of wine, so it must be some degree of success.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what I'm interested in is, first of all, improving both my skills, techniques, and knowledge on the wine making. I'm retired, and with the fascination I have, once I learn more about really what I need to be doing that I'm not, maybe explore the possibilities of, you know, a small winery with possibilities of expansion depending on the commercial success. But I really don't know where to start, so I'm encouraged by some of your comments today. But first, online courses, for example, or are there good books or resources to go to, and where do you start to for me to get to the next stage?
Sure. First, I'd just like to say this is really exciting for me to get these calls like this. You know, back in our early history, pre-Prohibition, everybody had grapes in their backyard. Everybody made their own wine. And that enthusiasm is starting to come back into the state now, which is really exciting. There are a ton of resources out there now on both hobby winemaking, which it sounds like you're at right now, and small-scale commercial production. One of the books I think that would probably be of the biggest help, and it's something I tend to carry around with me and wear out wherever I go is it's called Microvinification, and it's a book by Murli Damodikari, who was used to be the enology specialist over in Missouri, and now he's the enology specialist in Iowa, and he put this book together probably about 10 years ago, and it basically has everything the hobbyist needs to know and everything the small startup commercial winery needs to know as well. For getting started, if you wanted to go commercial, there are some resources available to you now. There is a program out of Renlight College in Southern Illinois called VESTA, the Viticulture and Enology Sustainable Technology Alliance, and they are offering online workshops and online courses so you can get a certificate for both winemaking and grape growing. So that is something that's just come online this year.
That's VESTA at the University of Southern Illinois?
It's at Wren Lake College. Yeah.
Lake College.
Wren Lake, yeah. It's
R-E-N-D.
Yeah, down in Southern Illinois. And
okay, yeah.
And I think they're doing a nice job really getting this program off the ground. I also, just this year, edited a workbook called Starting a Winery in Illinois. It was put together by my predecessor, Steve Menke, and the Illinois Wine and Grapes, Grape and Wine Resources Council, about 10 years ago. But I've gone through it this year and updated all the information. It has even a cost of establishment for a 5,000-gallon winery, has all the information you need to get all your licensing taken care of, which, trust me, is probably one of the greatest hurdles to getting a winery started. Most of us get into it because we like to make wine, not because we love to file taxes and jump through legal hoops. But it's available for download off the Illinois Wine website. It's just illinoiswine.com. So you could peruse that at your own leisure. But it does have some interesting workbook kind of things where it encourages you to write your business plan and figure out exactly how you're going to pull this off commercially.
Well, fantastic. This is exactly the kind of information I've been dreaming about for a few months here. So
yeah, well, definitely
appreciate it.
Yeah, check out illinoiswine.com because that's there. I think there's probably a link to VESTA, their program, too, on that website.
Well, thank you very much, and you've done a great job. I hope you come back and are a guest from time to time.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Next, we talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. You described the wild grape as the riverbank grape.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the same grape that you find growing in forest areas, say in Wisconsin, and in the hedgerows between fields?
I believe so, yeah, yeah.
Occasionally you find one that is quite sweet. Is this evidence of crossing with domestic grapes, or is it just that much variability in the species?
It could be some wild hybridization, and that's actually how we got grapes like Concord and the Labruscas, Niagara, basically red and white grape juice.
Mm-hmm.
That's how those came about mainly, was that they were planted in these old variety trials where they had harvested wild grape varieties in the Northeast and along the East Coast and planted them next to grapes that they brought over from Europe. So they had some chance hybridization. Without seeing them and really evaluating, it's really hard to get more specific than that. But there are probably 150 or so selections from the wild grape that have been made. They just call them Riparia 1 through Riparia 150 or something like that. The Frontenac parent is known as Riparia 89. So they just make these selections and basically propagate them and keep that true to type. They all have slight variability. Some will be sweeter than others. The wild grape tends to be really sweet and really high in sugar. You know, your standard wine grape will be anywhere from 18 to 24 percent sugar at harvest, and these have the ability to get up to 29, 30 percent sugar or more.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, then the fact that they make a very acid wine is because there's so much sugar that it fermentation can produce a lot of acid?
Well, no, that's just inherent in the grape, too.
Oh.
Tons of sugar and tons of acidity.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually made Riparia wine, and part of the process involves diluting it 50% with water, so you can actually get something that you can actually drink. Otherwise, it's more like the consistency of pudding.
Mm-hmm.
It's real thick and kind of disgusting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. And next we take a listener call on a cell phone line to Champaign County. Hi. We have a caller there in Champaign County. No, let's go on and take another call. Urbana, line 3. Hello. Urbana?
I'm on line 3.
Yep, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Your guest mentioned a low tannin red wine from southern Illinois, but I didn't get the. I was wondering if you could spell it and
let
me know if there's some good sources where one can purchase local wine such as that in Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, one of the biggest supporters of our Illinois wine industry is Friar Tuck, actually, here in Savoy.
Oh, okay.
And all over. But they have an entire aisle devoted to wines from Illinois, and the grape is called Chamberson. It's C-H-A-M-B O-U-R C-I-N.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And there are lots of hybrid red grape varieties that are very much in the same boat. Chamberson, Frontenac also has pretty low tannin. So they're very easy to drink. They don't have a long aging potential, but I think they're ideal for pairing with a lot of foods, especially meats that are real lean, wild game, for example, things like venison and ostrich. Not that we have wild ostriches, but it would pair really well with some of those lean red meats like that.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking today about wine. Our guest is Brad Beam. He's here at the University of Illinois. He provides extension support for commercial wineries in Illinois. He also teaches an introductory course on wine production and sensory analysis at the U of I. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments about wine. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Maybe here before we take another couple of calls, you would talk with us about what do you consider, Brad, when you're about to take the first sip of a glass of wine, and maybe it's something that's new to you.
Well,
how do you look at it?
When you first get a new glass of wine, it's always important to visually assess it. You know, look at the color, really try to take it in, figure out what kind of sensory experience it's going to be. And it can totally prepare your palate for what to expect, too. For example, if the wine's real, if it's a white wine that's real gold, real rich in color, has mm-hmm. a high viscosity, so it's pretty thick in the glass, that usually will indicate that it's either a late harvest dessert wine or that it's been in, or it's a dry wine that's been oak aged for a little while and put through malolactic fermentation, so it's real soft and has a nice body. But the visual aspect is really minimal, of minimal importance to me anyway. How it appears in the glass is pretty inconsequential. It's really all about aroma and flavor. So when you get a new glass of wine, depending on what it is, it doesn't hurt to give it some time to open up, let it sit in the glass for a little while, or get a decanter and open it out. And I do that for whites as well as reds. you know, for some of the big macho reds from like Southern Rhone red wines or something like that, or Bordeaux, you know, you're supposed to let them air out for quite a while. But I like to let the whites do that too, because I feel like the aromas and flavors after you pour them will actually develop a little bit in the glass as well. And you get some of that complexity going once you get some oxygen integrated into the wine. So I think probably when you first take, before you take your first sip, you know, you should really stick your nose into it and take your time and don't rush it and don't try to clear your mind of expectation. And that's what I try to get my students to do in class, is to really try to, I don't tell them that they're tasting a Chardonnay before they taste a Chardonnay, because I don't want them to immediately think of a certain aroma and flavor profile. And you'll be amazed at what you can pick out. There is a little device that I think is a lot of fun, and my students use it pretty frequently in class. It's called a wine aroma wheel, and it was developed by Ann Noble out of UC Davis. And basically, it's a wheel-shaped spectrum of flavor compounds in wine. And there are three rings to it, and the outermost ring is very general. I think I'm doing this backwards. I think the innermost ring is very general. It has like fruity, vegetative, et cetera. And then as you head out toward the outside of the circle, it gets very specific. So like one tier will be fruity. The second tier will be tree fruit. And the third tier will have apple, pear, peach, et cetera. To try to help you train your brain to pick out these different aromas. We're such a visual society that we have to almost retrain ourselves to really pick out aroma and flavor compounds in wine. And I think that's the big challenge. Once you get that, or at least get a handle on it, I think the more wines you taste, the better off you are.
Yeah. Do your students have to keep a journal?
I make them take notes on every wine. Yeah. And sometimes they hand them in for credit. Sometimes they just keep them. But the idea was by the end of the semester, they have a record of about 50 wines that we've tasted over the course of the semester that they've actually sat down and taken 15 minutes of time to really evaluate. So hopefully they'll appreciate that. Even if they don't now, hopefully they will this summer, next fall, when they're actually looking for wines to purchase.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a very interesting program. I have a question about, you know, you've been talking a lot about grapes and soils here in Illinois. Well, I lived in Iowa for about 3 years, and one of the strangest things I ever tasted there was dandelion wine. I'm calling in because I'm just curious about the different types of things you can use to make wine. I mean, I know there's things like peach brandy, and, you know, people seem to make alcoholic drinks out of a lot of different things. And first of all, I want to know if you ever tasted dandelion wine, but also whether in order to be considered a wine, it has to be a high quality wine. It has to always be made of grapes. I don't think I'm going to be driving back to Iowa for another glass of dandelion wine, but I'm just curious about what types of things can be used to make a wine. And what your thoughts are on that?
Yeah, well, I have. You can use almost anything. I even know one winemaker that claims that he can ferment shoe leather and make it taste good. Basically, when they make those things from vegetables, and yes, I've tasted many of them. I used to judge an amateur state fair wine competition.
Okay.
and you see the good, the bad, and the ugly there. Things made from tomatoes and things made from really, really disgusting things sometimes that you don't know how they got the idea and wish they had never gotten.
But, for example?
Army worm wine.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
I wasn't going to go there. But that's a winemaker in Duluth, Minnesota. It actually just smells and tastes like tomato leaves. You know?
Oh.
But which isn't pleasant, but I don't know. I guess he's out of range. He won't come after me for it. But so, you know, you can do that. And there are recipe books out there that will do that. But basically, they all stem from the idea that all you have to do to make wine is ferment sugar. So basically, they'll get water, like a 5-gallon bucket of water. For dandelion wine, they'll dump the dandelion heads in it, soak it for a long time, add a lot of sugar to it, and then ferment the sugar that they added. So really, they're just fermenting table sugar.
Oh, okay.
And it's flavored with the dandelion heads.
It's the dandelion. I wasn't sure whether it was the leaves or the heads they were using. It didn't taste very good, but just curious.
Well, I'm glad people do that, though. I mean, I think it keeps it's a fun hobby no matter what. Most people start out that way because they have a hard time finding grapes to start with. You know, and hopefully we're getting out of that realm where we're actually getting enough grapes around and more people are putting grapes in their backyard, like the previous callers that we've talked to. So hopefully that they can start working with some higher grade materials. But I say keep on doing that kind of stuff if it's what you're into. As long as it's fun, I don't see why you should stop.
Yeah. Okay, very interesting show. I'll keep listening. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing fine. It's great listening to you guys.
Thanks.
A couple comments. One, I'm wondering, do you have to be 21 to take your class?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We do card, by the way, for any other potential students out there.
Yeah. The other is, quite frankly, I'm wondering if you just wanted to produce, you know, maybe like the 12 bottles of wine, is there any rule of thumb to how many plants you'd need to produce how much grapes? And is there a, for a recreational hobbyist, is there a, and it's going to cost you X amount of dollars per bottle?
Well, the startup cost for the equipment will be kind of high. You know, you can get some 5-gallon carboys, some glass, you know, jugs, and basically that's about all you need. Getting the juice out of the fruit's always an issue for small hobbyists. You know, I have a pretty sophisticated crusher and a destemmer to take all the stems away from the grapes, and then a press to press all the juice out. Which is ideal, but, you know, people do it with glorified cheesecloth basic methods, you know, where they'll stomp on them with their feet and end up making the wine. So you can keep the cost pretty down to start with. I think probably the best way to do it, if you're really interested, is joining one of these winemaking clubs. And, like, we have an Amateur Winemakers of Central Illinois club here in town, and I think they meet about once a month or maybe once a quarter over at the Alto Vineyards here in town.
Uh-huh.
And they share equipment and share ideas, and they'll go in together on purchases of grapes from California, and they'll do all those kinds of things. And it's a really neat club, and I've gone and spoken with them a couple times and helped them out. And
great.
And it's also a great resource to help learn, you know, as you're getting started. So if you do buy fruit, you don't have a, you know, a $100 mistake to deal with on your hands.
Right. I've got land that's currently being farmed right now, and I've just always been really curious about doing it. I'm assuming that you could, if you really wanted to get into the growing the grapes, that you could probably then harvest the grapes and perhaps find somebody else that could process it for you.
Yeah. Well, like I said, the Amateur Winemakers Club, they have a crusher destemmer, I believe, or at least access to one. So you can always work with them. But I think they do have a website. I think it's awci.com.
AWCI?
Yeah, Amateur Winemakers of Central Illinois.
Very well.
And as far as things like bottles per plant, it all depends on the grape variety, but the standard rule of thumb would be anywhere from 15 to 20 pounds of fruit per gallon. And it's pretty common for a grape vine, a single vine, to produce about that much once it's mature. 15 to 25 pounds or so is pretty normal. So if you estimate about a gallon per vine, then that's 5 bottles per vine.
And I'm assuming, like, as soon as you plant in the ground, it's going to take several years.
Yeah, generally 3 to 5 years to really get a crop on the grapes before
they're
really.
Well, the good news is around here, at least our farm ground prices aren't like they are in Napa.
right. Absolutely.
All right, well, it's great program, and I'll just answer another question. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left in this portion of the program. We will definitely have to have you back on the program.
Oh, great.
I wanted to ask you about, my husband and I went out to dinner recently, and on the menu there were some suggestions for fortified wines, and it was really a cold night.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of my grandmother, who would offer the adults a little glass of sherry or port when they came in from the cold.
To warm your bones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was, you know, I was never old enough to do that with my grandmother, but I'm thinking about her now, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe that would also be a lovely thing to do with family and friends that come to my home now. So what do you recommend for people just coming in from the cold, and maybe you have, like, some little bits of food for them to eat, and a little port or sherry?
Yeah, ports are great wines, especially for the winter. Sherries, too. They're fortified, so the alcohol is pretty high, and they're usually very sweet. So, you know, if you were going to pair a food with them, you'd probably want a sweeter food, not something drier. You know, it might be like port and cookies, or I think port and chocolate actually are really good, like a ruby red port and chocolate are a really good pair, mainly because chocolate has sweetness and bitterness to go with it. And a lot of ports, as they age, start to get a little bit of that chocolatey character in them. It's a product of bottle aging that happens in red wines and things that are aged for a long time, like ports. So I think it's a great tradition. And there are literally, you know, hundreds to choose from, both, you know, true traditional ports from Portugal and other fortified wines, including ones made in Illinois that I think are of very outstanding quality. World-class quality, really.
No, really?
We don't call them ports because that's illegal, but we do have fortified dessert wines in that style. Frontenac makes an exceptional port, especially if you like that chocolate flavor because it really gets chocolatey. The other one that's gaining popularity, well, there are two. Chamberson also is made into a port wine sometimes. And Norton, which is actually another true Native American species of grape, which we don't have time to talk about, but it's kind of an interesting story. Was declared the answer to viticulture and grape growing in the eastern U.S. By people like Andrew Jackson and Abe Lincoln. So they all make really good ports. So we have a lot of options, and I certainly think it's a nice tradition to have. Another tradition that I think is neat about ports is to find a bottle of vintage port, and they only declare vintages in the best of years. To buy a bottle of vintage port, like, for example, I have two young nephews. I'll find the vintages, if they were born in a vintage year, buy that bottle. They can age for 20 years or more very easily. So open it with them on their 21st birthday. I think that's a fun little tradition. That's something I intend to start once I can find all the wines. They're sometimes hard to track down.
Well, among the things next time we can talk about are the Norton grape, vintages. Also, we never got around to champagne.
Oh, my gosh. So that's a crime.
Labels. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll get you signed up for a future date.
Great.
It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Brad Beam is with the University of Illinois. He provides extension support for commercial wineries in Illinois. He also teaches an introductory course on wine production and sensory analysis here at the University of Illinois. It's 1:53. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. The numbers in Chicago look really good today compared to Friday, if you're wanting the market to go higher, that is, of course. That's because the market did go higher today. Wheat futures in Chicago for the soft red ended 15 and a quarter higher. 481 and a half was the high, the low at 467, and a settlement price there at 15 and a quarter higher at 473 on the afternoon. March futures, $5 and a half, the high, the low at 478 and three quarter, settlement price at 490 and a half, up 15, and the May, 513, the high. Low at 492 and a quarter, settled at 503 and three quarters, up 15 and a quarter. July, the harvest month for the soft red, 526 and a half. On the high, the low at 501 and a half, a settlement price at $5.16 and three quarters, up 15 and a quarter for the day. December Kansas City wheat, 12 cents the gain at 501 and three quarters. Minneapolis Grain Exchange wheat at 573 for the spring wheat and three quarters of a cent, up 12 and three quarters of a cent. Back in Chicago in the corn pit, nearby December contract had a high today of $3.19, a low at 296 and three quarters, a settlement well above $3 at 314 and a quarter, up 20 and three quarters for the day. March futures 334 and three quarters the high, the low at 311, settled at 330, up 20 and three quarters in May. 345 on the high, the low at 22, settled at 340 and a half, 21 and a quarter higher. July 355 and a quarter for the high, the low at 331, settled at 350 and a quarter, up 21 and a half. And September corn futures 361 the high, the low at 42 and three quarters, settlement price at 360 and a quarter, up 21 and three quarters. That's the end of the old crop, now new crop. December futures 379 the high, the low at 54, settlement price for the December 09 corn contract at 373 and three quarters, up 22 and a half. cents. December oats today, $1.97. The trade for the high, the low at 92, and settled at 193.5, 9 cents the gain. March futures 208, up 9 as well. Soy complex, January beans, 827.5 the high, the low at $7.88.5. Settlement price at $8.20.5, up 37 cents. March futures 831.5 the high, the low at 792. Settled at 825.5, up 38.25. And the May contract, 840 the high, low at 798. Settlement price at $8.35, up 40.25. July futures, 850 on the high, the low at 807.75. Settlement price at 845.5, up 40.5 cents. And next year's November soybeans, 846.5, the high, the low at 810.25. Settlement price, 844. November beans for 2009 settled 41.5 cents higher on the afternoon. December bean meal, $250, 80 cents a ton, the high. The low at 244. Settlement price at 249.30, up $8.80. January at 247.70, up $9.40. December bean oil, 29.75, the high, the low at 29.13. Settled 29.48, up 123. And January bean oil, 29.77, the settlement price up 122 on the afternoon. During the closing market report today, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
For the most part, the livestock contracts finished on the upside today. December live cattle, 83.30, the high 82.60, the low 83.10, the settlement at up 155. February, 83.30, the high 82.55, the low 82.67.5, the settlement at up 122.5. April, 85.40, the high 84.35, the low 84.80, the settlement at up 142.5. June, 81.52.5, the high 80.40, the low 81.17.5, the settlement that up 162.5. January feeder cattle, 88.90, the high 87.50, the low 87.90, the settlement at up 125. March, 87.65. The high, 86.60, the low, 86.92.5, the settlement, that up 165. April, 88.55, the high, 87.70, the low, the settlement, 87.92.5, that finishing up 152.5. And May feeder cattle, 89.75, the high, 88.77.5, today's low for May feeder cattle. And the settlement, 88.92.5, up 112.5. December lean hogs, 57.75, the high 56.85, the low 56.97.5, the settlement, that down 47.5. February, 65.40, the high 64.05, the low 64.12.5, the settlement, that down 7.5. April, 70.82.5, the high 69.70, the low, the settlement 69.92.5, that up 55. And May lean hogs, 76.50, the high 75.35, the low, the settlement 76.45, that up 120. February pork bellies, 89.95, the high 87.30, the low, the settlement 89.45, that down 85. Stocks are surging on Wall Street at the moment. The Dow is currently up 337 points at 89.72. The Nasdaq up 69 at 1578. The S&P 500 up 37 points at 913. And oil up 284 at 43.65 at the Mercantile Exchange in New York, that nearby futures month. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. The producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director today is Jason Croft. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up, we're going to have news from National Public Radio and then the closing market report with Todd Gleason. Let's take a look at the forecast from Ed Kieser for Illinois and Indiana. Freezing rain advisory in effect for southern portions of northern Indiana until 4 o'clock Eastern time for much